With great mojo comes great responsibility. Mojo 5-0.
Mojo 5-0.
We will make America great again.
Sam Sorbo.
And welcome back to the Sam Sorbo Show. I'm your host, Sam Sorbo. My guest now is Tim Barton. He is the president of Wall Builders. He's also the author of this new book called The American Story, The Beginnings. It's an incredible book that shows America's history from the Pilgrims all the way to the Civil War. Welcome to the program, Tim Barton.
Thanks for having me on.
So I met Tim just a little while ago, actually. I was out there in Dallas, and they've got this museum, Wall Builders has this museum in conjunction with, I'm not sure exactly what the relationship is, but in conjunction with Glenn Beck, who has sort of taken it on as a personal mission to save American artifacts. And I remember when this became so apparent, because they were tearing down statues. And Glenn Beck says, "Ooh, I'll take them. Can you send them to me? I'll pay for shipping." And so I don't know if you guys were working together before then, or how it all worked out. Do you want to just talk about that briefly?
Sure. Yeah, we've been working with Glenn for 10 or 12 or 15 years now. Back when Glenn was on Fox, he used to have my dad on. They would do what was called Founders Fridays. And every Friday, they would just spend some time learning something about American history. And we had a very large collection back then. And Glenn was so impressed with our collection, it really encouraged him to start collecting some things as well. And then as we saw some of the craziness in the last couple of years, with a lot of people literally trying to tear down American history, with a lot of the rewriting of American history from the 1619 Project, from now critical race theory, there's even a greater need to collect and preserve some of these artifacts that help tell the true story of America. And so we've partnered with Glenn. Mercury One is his nonprofit. My dad and I are both on the board at Mercury One. And one of the objectives of Mercury One, there's an education initiative, which is to help tell the true story of America. And that's, again, what we do at Wall Builders, is we try to present the forgotten history and heroes of America. And so that's where we've kind of joined together over the last decade or so.
And in fact, that's basically what brought you to write this book, the American Story, The Beginnings.
Yes.
So talk to me about that.
So we start with Christopher Columbus, and we roughly go through the ending of slavery in America. Initially, we were going to start with Columbus, right, when he discovers, quote unquote, the New World. And we were going to go through the Constitution when America finally really becomes a nation. And when we were finishing this book up, it was in 2019, and the 1619 Project was coming out, and they were making all of these crazy claims about America, and crazy in the sense of so historically inaccurate and unfounded, outlandish some of the things they were saying. And we thought, we really need to help correct some of the stories. So we decided to go, instead of just when George Washington becomes president, we said, let's take it through roughly the end of slavery in America. So even though we can acknowledge that there are some true things that the 1619 Project would claim, that there actually was slavery in America, some of those things are true, but the ending of that narrative or the rest of the story is just very different than what's been going on. And so that's what we thought. Let's just tell the true story of America. And looking at the true story of America, it's true that America is not the story of a perfect nation or people. There have been so many moments in American history where there was sinful, wicked, evil things that happened, and yet that's not the whole story of America, because every time there were sinful, wicked, or evil things happening, there were people that stood up to oppose those sinful, wicked, and evil things. And America, like every other nation, has had her failures and had her mistakes. But America, unlike other nations, has corrected those mistakes faster than virtually any other nation of the world. But we try to just tell the honest story of what happened and present the truth and let the chips fall where they may.
I think that the important point to make here is that for a leftist, there is no such thing as forgiveness. Mm-hmm. Whereas for a Christian, that's what it's all about. If we try to create a society in which forgiveness is no longer an option, then no one will survive.
Right.
And so the idea is, their narrative is, history started, the history of America started at 1619 and never went anywhere from there. There's nothing that you can do after that to redeem that one thing. So even if they were to, say, succeed at tearing America down, there's still nowhere to go, because what are they going to start with? They'll start with something that's tarnished with the vestiges of the thing that they tried to eliminate anyway.
Yeah, it's one of the old Marxist ideologies that the goal is to tear down the existing nation or the status quo as it was. And so the idea is that you're just going to find a problem. And it's kind of Marxist thought where that there's two classes of people. You have the oppressed and the oppressors. But one of the things Marx said is sometimes you have to even inform the oppressed people that they are oppressed, because they might not even realize they're oppressed.
That's right.
This is what we are doing in America. We are creating a new narrative, because even if we look at the 1619 Project, the claim is that the first black slaves arrived in America in 1619. Now, historically, that's very inaccurate, because you can go back to the 1500s. There were Spanish colonies in America, in North America, back in the 1500s. And the Spaniards, if people would remember and study history, the Spaniards were one of the big slave traders. And so back in the 1520s, there were actually African slaves being brought over on Spanish ships to the Spanish colonies. So 1619.
By the way, who was catching the African slaves and selling them into slavery? Who did that?
Oh, you mean the other African tribes? Oh, okay. Oh,
right. So it was the African tribes that enslaved each other first.
So yeah, the story of the African slave trade is for me, it's fascinating, as I love studying history. For some people, it might not be as fascinating. I love it. I love studying history and learning the story. But if you go back, one of the things you see is there were, in North Africa, there were Muslim nations. And the Muslim nations, slavery was a part of the Muslim empire, the Muslim ideology going all the way back to the formation of Islam, right? Today.
Is.
We know there's slavery all around the world, and slavery is legal in many of those Islamic nations around the world. That's part of their religion, it's part of their foundation. But if you go back to the African slave trade, you had these Muslims in North Africa who were capturing Europeans. And one of the things they realized is they could start selling and trading and making money with this. And then they begin not only buying slaves from the African tribes, they begin giving some of these African tribes weapons of war so that they could more effectively go out and capture some of these slaves to now make this intercontinental slave trade in Africa, which then went from the intercontinental slave trade to the exporting of slaves off the continent. So there's a lot of history with there. You can go back to the Dutch, the Portuguese, the Spaniards, but the Muslims were one of the chief instigators in a lot of what went on in North Africa. But you're right. It was Africans capturing other Africans to sell them to the slave traders who eventually brought them to America. But let's go back to the 1619 Project. The 1619 narrative is that's when the first shipload of slaves arrived in Jamestown. That's only kind of true. It's kind of true because there were two British privateer ships. They captured a Portuguese slave trading ship. And when they captured the ship, they took all the cargo, all of the booty off, and they divided it between the two British ships. But one of the British ships realized we don't have a place for these approximately 19 slaves. They said, let's go drop them off in Jamestown. So they took them to Jamestown. And this is when people say this is the first shipload of slaves that arrived in Jamestown. But here's where it becomes more interesting. And I would encourage everybody listening, everybody watching right now, don't take my word for it. Look this up. Slavery was illegal in Jamestown in 1619. So when these slaves arrived in Jamestown, they actually, and the people of Jamestown, the British privateer captain said, we need to sell these slaves. And the people of Jamestown said, well, we don't have slavery here. And the captain said, well, what do you have here? They said, we have indentured servitude here. He said, okay, well, can I sell them to you as indentured servants? The people said, yes. And they bought the 19 slaves as indentured servants. But here's where it's so important. Indentured servitude was a very specific time frame that you would serve for usually about 7 years. At the end of 7 years, you were given your freedom. And in Jamestown, they not only gave you your freedom, they gave you land. You became a free landowner in America. It's believed this Portuguese ship that had these original slaves was going to either Cuba or Jamaica. And had these slaves arrived in Cuba or Jamaica, the lifespan of slaves in Cuba and Jamaica was maybe a year to 3 years. So they likely would have met their death in Cuba or Jamaica. However, because they came to Jamestown, all 19 of them became indentured servants. At the end of 7 years, they were given their freedom and they were free landowners. And I understand the argument might be, yes, but that was still a terrible 7 years. Let's say it was a terrible 7 years. For 7 years, they were abused and mistreated. Okay, let's agree that maybe it was terrible for 7 years. However, had they gone anywhere else, could they have had a better outcome? And by the way, I'm not defending Jamestown. I think Jamestown had so many errors, so many flaws, so many faults with Jamestown. I'm just saying the narrative, the way it's being told today, is not being honest in what happened. Chattel slavery was not legal in Jamestown until a court decision in 1653. And that's when chattel slavery or the African slave trade became legal in Jamestown. So again, I'm not defending Jamestown. I'm just saying the history that's being told is not even close to the accurate story of what really happened.
Because they don't care.
Right. The agenda is to make America look bad.
Right.
It's not to be honest about history.
Right. Because if you're honest about history, we also had Irish slaves in America.
Absolutely. There was a lot of white slaves in America, the Scots, the Irish, there was a lot of people. And I mean, we could go even further and say, even after the Civil War, you could talk about the Asians that were involved in the expansion of the railroad. People would argue, well, they weren't slaves because they paid them like a dollar a day. No. I mean, for what they went through, there was slavery, and nobody really talks about the Irish or the Scots or the Europeans. Nobody really talks about the Asians that were in, again, I'm going to say they were enslaved, but the Asians that were part of the railroad, at least not on the modern narrative.
Well, what about the child mine workers?
Sure.
I mean, you know, to focus on one thing to the exclusion of everything else, basically, and say, this is where it all started, and you're wrong. it's absurd. But let's talk about, because we got 9/11 here. It's the 20th anniversary, and we're trying to figure out how to move forward from everything that we've seen over the past year and a half. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. Obviously, if we look back on 9/11, I remember where I was. I was a freshman in college when those Twin Towers were hit. And I'd imagine anybody who's over 30 years old can remember exactly where they were the moment it happened. I remember growing up, my parents would talk about, they remember where they were when JFK was shot. And it seemed weird to me that something would be that significant that it's ingrained in you where you were. And then 9/11 happened. And I remember so much about that day just being frozen, looking at the TV. And it was such a big deal. And when that happened, a lot of Americans thought, this is a brand new scenario we are walking into. This is unprecedented, not realizing that actually Osama bin Laden, who is largely credited for planning those attacks on 9/11, For literally the last decade, he had been planning and helping orchestrate attacks against embassies, against military bases, against military ships. This was not a brand new thing even leading into 9/11, but this is something that a lot of times today, we are maybe getting a little better glimpse of it right now, obviously with the Biden debacle in Afghanistan. What we are seeing is the resurgence of the Taliban. We are seeing inside of the Taliban, you're seeing a rise of Al-Qaeda. Intelligence tells us, right, ISIS is back on the ground. And you're seeing this conglomeration of terrorist groups once again in the Middle East. And for a lot of Americans, they're struggling to understand some of this ideology. But for many of us, we're recognizing that one of the things that it's now taken us 20 years to realize, the war against terror was not a war against a nation. It was a war battling an ideology that terrorists were embracing an ideology. And here's where, as someone who studies history, becomes interesting. If you go back to early America, back to the American Revolution, prior to the American Revolution, we were British citizens in a British colony. And so the British Navy was the most powerful Navy in the world. And so any of our American trade ships had the protection of the British Navy. But after the American Revolution, or even during the American Revolution, the British Navy was no longer protecting American trade ships. And so you had nations, specifically Muslim nations in North Africa, that began attacking American trade ships. And actually, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson were two individuals that got sent to try to negotiate with these Muslim nations about what can we do to stop these attacks on our trade ships. And when they came back, they had some fascinating writings. But one of the things that they pointed out was they were shocked to discover when they talked to this Muslim ambassador that he said it was part of their law, Sharia law, that they were supposed to fight a war against infidels and non-believers. They were supposed to enslave and kill in the name of their God. And they couldn't believe it. In fact, this is when it was reported that Jefferson bought his very first ever Quran because he wanted to actually find out what they were believing and what led them to this position. But this began a several decades exchange between America and these nations of North Africa, these Muslim nations, that actually didn't go well for America for a long time. Because one of the things that Jefferson and Adams pointed out was to live at peace with the Muslims, actually we had to either fight well or pay well. Because the only options were you would pay the jizya, you're paying them essentially ransom to not kill you, or you would convert to Islam or they kill you. Well, we weren't going to convert to Islam. We didn't want to die. So we were going to pay this ransom bounty, this extortion money, And so that's what we did. In fact, if you go back under George Washington, part of the very first federal budget included money going to those Muslim nations of North Africa to not attack our trade ships. They did, in fact, at times still attack those trade ships. This is why George Washington said, "Would to heaven I had a navy to crush these infidels into non-existence." He wanted a navy to be able to fight back to make these people leave us alone. Well, the navy was completed under John Adams. John Adams became known as the father of the American Navy. But John Adams, when he was president, 10% of the federal budget was spent paying these Muslim nations from North Africa to not attack America. And people called for John Adams to send our navy to go fight against these Muslim terrorists to make them leave us alone. And John Adams refused to send the navy. And it's very fascinating. John Adams knew something back then that very few people recognize today.
Adams says, before you continue, because I have to take a quick break, I want to just tell people we're talking with the author of The American Story, The Beginnings, Tim Barton. He's also the president of Wall Builders. Do you have a website for people to go to, Tim?
Yeah, wallbuilders.com is the best website.
Okay, wallbuilders.com. I'm going to take a quick break here, and we'll be right back with Tim Barton. This is the Sam Sorbo Show. We'll be right back. All right. Welcome back to the Sam Sorbo Show. My guest is Tim Barton. He's the president of Wall Builders and also the author of this book called The American Story, The Beginnings. And he was giving us a little bit of a rundown of America's history with Muslim nations and Muslim tribes. And this idea that the Muslims in their religious texts are actually required to attack non-Muslims. And so Thomas Jefferson recognized this. George Washington finally recognized it. And so they did, and John Adams as well. And we were just catching up with what John Adams finally realized, which was...
Yeah, so John Adams refused to send the Navy. Once we finally had an American Navy built, he would not send them to war against these Muslim nations because John Adams pointed out, we're not merely fighting a nation, we are fighting an ideology. And John Adams said the American people do not have the stomach for a prolonged war. And because we're not merely fighting a navy, but we're fighting ideology, it would take years or decades for us to overcome this ideology and to remove it. Now, that's the reason he didn't send the navy, which is an interesting thought because now 20 years later, the Taliban is still in Afghanistan. They have the same ideology. It's because we're fighting an ideology of Islamic extremism. It's not merely a nation, but Thomas Jefferson became president, and Jefferson was like, you know what? Forget this. The Muslims began demanding 15% of our federal budget, which at that point, our federal budget was growing, and so their demands were increasing, and Jefferson says, no, send the Navy. We're done with this.
Well, I think Jefferson also said, we fought the British over a 2% tax? Like,
right. So. Yeah, we went to war with the British over a penny tax, and certainly he was willing to have a war over this. We had peace treaty after peace treaty that the Muslim nations continued to violate. It wasn't until after the War of 1812 that we finally had a peace treaty that lasted longer. But this was, again, when the Muslim nations began to learn. One of the things that John Adams and Thomas Jefferson had discovered is that either you have to fight well or pay well. Well, we stopped paying well, but we started fighting very, very well. And that kept them from attacking us predominantly because we had such a strong navy at that point. But this is something, again, today we're looking at this going, well, why are we having these problems with the Taliban in America? Or, right, you have so many of these woke professors and woke Americans who think that, you know, all of these rights for whatever LGBTQ plus, you know, all of these women's studies in Afghanistan. And well, the Biden administration is telling us, well, no, the Taliban has agreed to continue this or they won't be recognized on the world stage, as if that was their motivation. We are so dumb if we still to this point do not recognize this ideology that we are battling from Sharia law. And we can be honest and say, of course, not every Muslim agrees with what ISIS is doing. Not every Muslim agrees with Sharia law and these extreme forms. But there is a very large contingent of Muslims who hold very strongly to Sharia law, and including in these are the Taliban, is Al-Qaeda, is ISIS. These are actual terrorist organizations. And this is not the first time America's dealt with it, but this now proves true. The old adage that if you don't learn from history, you are doomed to repeat it. We are finding ourselves repeating history time and time again because we have forgotten the lessons we learned generations ago.
And now we've given them a whole bunch of military equipment.
Yes. Now, not only have we negotiated with terrorists, we have now improved the terrorist military positions. We have given them better technology than they have ever had. And the reality is, in the next several years, we will see, and by the way, even right now, as we have Americans stuck on the ground in Afghanistan, and the only way that Taliban is going to release these planes is if you give them an incredible amount of money. So we are now funding terrorism, and we're going to see in the coming years incredible acts of terrorism coming from some of the military weapons that we gave these terrorists, from the funding that we gave these terrorists.
And yeah, there's I think it was a Babylon Bee article that said Biden single-handedly brought the United States to the forefront as the number one funder of terrorism in the world.
And the Babylon Bee, although it's supposed to be satire, sadly is spot on in many of their satirical things, because obviously when somebody's writing satire, they're thinking nobody's this dumb. And yet the Biden administration continues to prove them wrong, that they are that dumb.
Oh, geez. All right. So tell me about the book, The American Story, The Beginnings.
So we start with Christopher Columbus discovering the New World, so to speak. We go roughly through the ending of slavery in America, and we try to just tell more of the honest story.
What was Christopher Columbus's motivation?
So really interesting. If you go through his journal, he has a book of prophecies. He largely believed that God had called him to be a discoverer and explorer. But really, you can back up to even some of the jihads that were going on in Europe. There was a land trade route going from Europe into Asia, that there was a jihad happening. And so the trade route was blocked off. And Columbus believed that the earth was round. He was
correct.
Is
that the Silk Road?
Well, correct. Columbus believed the earth was round. He just thought it was much smaller. He didn't know there was an entire other continent in the way.
Right.
And so he thought he was going to sail around and get to Asia. But the reason he was having to sail in the first place, or thought he should sail in the first place, was because of this Muslim jihad that was happening that interrupted the trade routes. But as Columbus then discovers the New World, discovers some of these islands, right, the Caribbean islands, so to speak, as he discovers that, you can read through his journal, and it's even interesting, Columbus gets accused of a lot of things that he's really not guilty of today if you actually go back and study who he was and what he did. Certainly he wasn't perfect. He did go to war at times against the natives, but like even the natives he went to war against, it was his second voyage, and he went to war against a native tribe that had killed and eaten some of his people. The tribe was known as the Caribbean tribe, where the word Caribbean comes from. It was also known as the Canib tribe, where the word cannibal comes from. And after some of Columbus's men were killed and eaten, Columbus joined with another native tribe, the Taino tribe, and together they went on the warpath against the Caribbee tribe, and that's the tribe that Columbus actually did kill some of those natives, that his men killed some of the natives, and they enslaved some of the Caribbee men. But it's worth noting, Columbus only ever approved of enslaving people that he fought in a justified war, because in the 1400s, if you fight a war, at the end of the war, there's only two options for the survivors of the people you defeated, and that's either you enslave them or you kill them. That was just the way of the world. But Columbus didn't randomly go around and start enslaving these natives. He actually had very good friends and allies among native tribes. But again, this is just where there's more context. But one of the arguments people say against Columbus is he was so greedy for gold. Actually, go back and read his writings. Because one of the things he wrote to the king and queen was he says his desire was that the majority of the valuables they find be used in going back in a conquest, going to seize back Jerusalem from these Muslim infidels that had taken it and kicked the Christians out. Columbus actually wanted gold for the retaking of Jerusalem, because Columbus, and again in his writings, Columbus thought that Jesus was going to return in the next 100 years, and he thought we need Jerusalem back in the hands of the Jews and the Christians before Jesus returns. His motivation is so different than what people say today if you would go back and read some of his writings. Now, most people don't want to read that many writings,
right,
which is why we did the book, to condense and simplify, to show you some of those things along the way.
And I've read that Christopher Columbus was extremely devout, and he was an evangelist. And so a lot of his travels was to convert people to Christianity, which is why he was against, you know, the cannibalism, which is, you know, it's funny because the argument of the leftists today would be that's their truth. So, you know, we really need to get our stories straight. But Howard Zinn wrote the
History of the American People.
The History of the American People, in which he quotes Christopher Columbus, but actually misquotes him, quotes him out of context.
Correct.
Saying that I'm sure you're aware of this, saying that he thought that these people would be so easily enslaved. And the rest of that quote is, and so we must protect them and educate them so that they won't be so easily enslaved. And Howard Zinn completely takes that out of context and says, see, he approved of slavery.
Correct. Yeah, I've even seen an article in the last year where somebody was arguing about how Columbus was one of the first sex slave traffickers. And they went to a letter from Columbus where Columbus said that they were selling girls for a certain amount and women for a certain amount. And they said, see, Columbus approved of selling these women, except he was writing back to the king. Like, again, read the whole letter. He was writing to the king and queen, and he was telling them about people who were doing stuff so evil that they were kidnapping girls and women, and they were selling them. And he said, this is why I put a stop to it. Columbus never approved of that. But when you take something out of context, you can make even the most vile person seem good, or someone who actually was very honorable seem very bad.
And to bring it full circle, if you take the 1619 Project, not only are they taking it out of context, but they're completely ignoring the actual historicity. It's been completely debunked. That does not mean that it's out of our schools.
Correct. We know the 1619 Project is being taught literally in all 50 states in America. Just like, I mean, we're seeing right now with so many parents getting involved and fighting at school boards because they're seeing schools and teachers in that district teaching critical race theory. It's the same thing with the 1619 Project, that some of these teachers are so woke, they're embracing this ideology that they are teaching this in public schools, which is why we tell parents, you need to be very careful if your kids are in public school. You need to be very engaged in that situation, have a lot of conversations, and get involved with the school board, because this stuff is being taught in schools.
Yeah, they need to pull their children out of school, because getting involved in school, I'm just going to say it, getting involved on the school board to do what? To put it back to what? To put it back to the same stuff that got us here where we are today? That's not going to work.
No.
And by the time you get that done, it'll be too late for your kids. So great. Fight the school board all you want for other people's kids, but pull your kids out. Save your own children first, right?
Absolutely. And this is why we've seen the explosion in the homeschool community, where it's now nearly 15% of the population in America is now actively homeschooling their kids. We've seen an incredible growth in Christian schools and in private schools, because as many good teachers as we could identify, there's great people in the public school system. Okay, but that's like saying the band on the Titanic was really good. That doesn't mean that shit's not going down, right? Like, the public school system is failing. It is going down because the system itself is broken. So it doesn't matter if you have good teachers in the system itself is broken. And you're right. You don't want to sacrifice your kids at the altar of this broken system.
That's awesome. Thanks so much for saying that. I'm going to use that. Tim Barton, president of Wall Builders. You can go to wallbuilders.com for more information. It's great work that you're doing. We need to preserve our history. We ought to all be excited about history, and we aren't, because in school we were taught to hate history because of the way they teach it in school, frankly. His book is called The American Story, The Beginnings. The American Story, The Beginnings. I sense a sequel coming.
Yes.
Yes, I'm sure. Tim Barton, thanks so much for coming on the Sam Sorbo Show. I'm Sam Sorbo. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you want more great interviews, go to sorbos.locals.com. That's sorbos.locals.com. And for any other information about me or my guests, go to samsorbo.com, where you'll find all of my books, including this fancy poster that I just made for my Words for Warriors book. You can check that out at samsorbo.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. And welcome back to the Sam Sorbo Show. I'm Sam Sorbo, your host. So joining me right now is this. I found this so fascinating. Somebody gave me a book at a conference where I was just speaking, and the book really struck me. It says 50 Things Every Child Needs to Know Before Leaving Home. It is a beautiful book. And so I'm now here with the author, Josh Mulvihill. He's the executive director of Church and Family Ministry at Renew a Nation, which is all one word. Renew a Nation, I imagine it's a website also. It's a ministry that helps children develop a biblical worldview by equipping the church, the home, and the school. And he serves as, he's been a pastor for 20 years with a PhD in family ministry from the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Welcome to the program. And thank you so much for this absolutely gorgeous book.
Yeah, well, you know, truth is one thing and beauty is another. And when they're combined, it's really attractive.
And then you need the third part of that trilogy, the goodness part, which is, so I've said for a long time, and it's not, you know, I didn't make this up. This is the truth. The purpose of education was and ought to be teaching a child to discern truth, beauty, and goodness. Why? Because truth, beauty, and goodness are the attributes of God, and that is how we discover God. And when you're not teaching children that, you're actually teaching them the opposite. And it's a distraction, which is really what I found our education institutions now to be engaged in, the distraction away from education. Why don't you comment on that, and we'll take it from there.
Yeah, our country has definitely lost a vision for the education of our children, and it has really become about job preparation and career readiness, which is not a bad thing, but it's not the thing. And we see definitely a different vision in God's word being wisdom and obedience and becoming like the Lord. And I love what Paul says to Timothy, equipped for every good work. And of course, that starts with the heart and moves out. But this book, 50 Things, really is essentially holistic in that nature, to be thinking about discipleship and education both as one.
So I wanted to show everybody the book because it's really very pretty. It's a thick book. Since I have it here, I'll just show it. Mm-hmm. I love the cover. It's remarkable, and it's full of great ideas that you want to have with your discussion points that you want to have with your children. I want to push back just a little bit on something that you said, though. This idea that our schools are engaged in, look, and it's what they have said themselves. Their focus is college prep and career readiness, which is really just about getting a job, which is really just about making a ton of money. And you said, well, it's not a bad thing. I'm going to say that is a bad thing, because by making that their focus to the exclusion of all else, really, it's not college prep, career readiness, and how to be a good citizen, and anything else. It's just that. And by focusing on just that, you know, we never ask, well, what's missing? Well, everything else is missing. God is missing. Citizenship is missing. Values and morals are missing. How to be a good parent, how to be a good child, how to be a good steward of the money that you make. All of that is missing. And so the system is now a distraction from the things that matter more. It's not that a good job doesn't matter. It's that it's the low man on the totem pole of what we ought to be teaching our children to value. Am I wrong?
No, and I think that was you expanded in, you know, I said what I said in a sentence, in that I think as parents, we all care that our kids are properly prepared for the adult world that they will, move into. But if the end goal is career readiness and college prep for a job, like you've said, to make money in order to be happy, it's a short-sighted goal. And it obviously is not enough. When we look into God's word and we see what does God want for us with our children, if they achieve Harvard, but they don't get to heaven, we have missed the picture entirely. And so should some of those elements be part of our picture and our vision? Absolutely. You know, we don't want to launch a child into the world that is unable to work, has a bad work ethics, unable to hold down a job. But if that's it, that's short-sighted. And so, I think we do need a greater vision as parents. What is the purpose of education? Who is responsible for it? What does that entail? How do we go about that? You know, those are all questions that the Bible answers for us. And it seems, I've been a pastor. I was told by my elder board at one point that I wasn't allowed to talk about the subject of education. And I don't think that that's too abnormal in the church world today. And what has happened is that parents don't have guidance from their church leaders on this subject, and they are essentially left to kind of find direction themselves, and that's problematic.
What did you do when the board said to you, don't talk about it? First of all, I'm flabbergasted. Your board said, don't talk about education. Did you go find a new church? What happened?
I found a new path. And so we started talking about biblical worldview and truth and belief systems. And so
at
I just
the, had at the church?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
So you talked about education.
I did in a different way. Yep. You know,
well, here's the thing. Like you say we want our kids to, you know how to hold a job. I would put to you that if they are trained in virtue and godly morals and taught how to steward money, for instance, they will know how to have a good, how to hold a job. They will know how to get a job. They will know how to give a good interview, because when the parent trains up the child in the way that he should go, that's all encompassing, right?
It is. But it comes down to purpose, too. So that, you know, what's the motive for those things? And a lot of parents, I think their priorities, whether they intend to or not, they're off in the reason that they are teaching those things. And we oftentimes absorb these worldly focuses that kind of get intermingled with our, you know, what we would see in scripture. And we think that's a good thing. And our kids then end up pursuing comfort and pleasure and indulgence, and nice things are obviously not problematic, but when they become the thing, that's where Christ gets pushed out. And we, you know, as the Bible says, you can only have one master. So which is it going to be in education?
Right. So what are you hoping for from this book, 50 Things Every Child Needs to Know Before Leaving Home? What's the end goal with this book?
Well, we, you know, as a pastor, I've just seen a lot of abdication of parents to others, whether that's the church, education, or other.
So, why do you suppose that is? I've identified in the United States and probably elsewhere in the world a failure of parenting, a failure of knowledge of how to parent, the definition of parent. What do you attribute that to? Or do you agree with that?
I do agree with it. I think we have a jurisdictional violation happening in that, you know, we've given over the education of our kids to an institution, to the government, that it never belonged to. And with that, the church has followed suit, and age-based ministry in the church came out of age-based grading in the school system. And it, you know, I know one of the individuals who founded what is known in the youth ministry world as Youth Specialties. It's kind of like the grandfather of youth ministry. He's in his 70s now. And I asked him, you know, your baby youth ministry that you founded in the 1960s is an adolescent now. What do you think about that? What would you change? And he just said, you know, we built the model on what he called the theory of individuation, that for young people to mature to adulthood, they had to be separated from their family of origin. They needed some time alone, essentially, as youth. And he said, we applied that to the church. And we said, well, if youth need that, then they need that in the church, separated from their family. So that's essentially how youth ministry, children's ministry was developed. It separates children from their families in peer groups. And the church has not been able to break that model. And so we, your question, what causes that? It's a complicated question, but the educational impact of secular education, parents stepping away, grandparents not understanding their role scripturally, the church that has become watered down in its preaching, I believe they all combine to really, you know, we're losing our kids in that process.
So I'm unclear. Were you saying that the youth group movement, say, was detrimental? Or, I'm unclear as to what you meant by that.
I'm saying the youth group movement was founded on an unbiblical approach, an unbiblical idea that sees children separated from a church congregation, from older generations, as the key to helping them develop in maturity. And not that I see any problem with children's youth ministry, but the way that the church has gone about it in isolation from creates all kinds of issues. You don't mature in your faith by being around other immature individuals. You have to be around more mature believers. And
so I love that. First of all, I love that you're saying that. I totally agree. I've said for a long time that our churches shouldn't have Sunday school. They should have kids in service. And the reason they have Sunday school is because they said, well, look at the public schools. And by the way, I'm oversimplifying, but this is the paradigm that I think sort of happened in a very generalized way. The parents were bringing their kids to church, but the kids were going to school all day. The parents stopped parenting because the kids were away all day. They brought them to church. The kids were disruptive. The parents didn't know what to do about it. The pastor said, I got to get the kids to stop, disrupting my sermon. I want to give my sermon here. Hey, let's take the kids out of the church and we'll give them fun things to do. And we'll also, by the way, of course, we'll teach them some of the gospel, like VeggieTales or what have you. And so what happened was they infantilized church so that it became a bunch of fairy tales. And now we're wondering why the youth are leaving the church in droves. Youth groups, you know, my kids would go and try to join a youth group, and they would come home inevitably with most youth groups and say, it was just pizza and hanging out. There wasn't really any substantial conversation. And they're looking for the conversation because I've taught them that that's where value is found. It's found in the conversation. We ought to be encouraging parents to have conversation with their children. They don't know how to do it because no one had conversation with them growing up.
Yeah. 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 And I love hearing that. And I think if parents just simply said, we are taking the responsibility, we are getting serious, we need to commit long-term to the discipleship of our kids. And, you know, if our church offers something for children and youth, it's a bonus, it's a supplement, it's a plus, but we're not going to be relying on that as the key influence in our kids' life to help them know, love, and serve Christ. And, you know, too many parents, I believe, have gotten that backwards, is that what they do at home supplemental to what they think
yes,
is happening.
Yeah. Exactly. Oh, I'm just going to drop my kid off. He'll get all the Jesus he needs there. We don't have to have that conversation. Whew, because I'm not very good on my own theology. How am I going to teach the Bible? I never read the Bible. I mean, it's absurd. And I think that the church really ought to start a movement to encourage parents in parenting, basically in parenting biblically and using the Bible as the textbook, right?
Yeah.
And I'm saying it wrong because the Bible, while it is a textbook, I don't want to, that word's almost a pejorative, so I don't want to use that word. But the idea that parents need to take both reins in their hands and learn how to ride this pony of parenting, and it's going to take, it can be a heavy lift, you know. I had a parent say to me the other day, I've got some, how did he put it? It was melancholy. Now, anyway, he said, I've got some news. You know, we enjoyed homeschooling last year, but our child was so much for my wife that we decided that we would put the child in this little Christian school. And I'm like, so you're going to ask the school to do a job that your wife couldn't do one-on-one with a child in a classroom with 20 other kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
how is that going to, you know, it doesn't work.
No.
You're going to lose the child, and then maybe the child will get some Jesus. Like, maybe the child will get some discipline. But you're going to lose the child, because don't tell me the child doesn't know what's going on. That's the other thing, is parents think that kids aren't savvy enough. One of the first articles I wrote about the crisis that we have in our schools is that parents who struggle through you've seen it. We've all heard it. Oh, you've got three teenagers. Wow, you've got your hands full. The eye roll and the, ugh, teenagers, what can you do? And my answer is, yeah, full of love. My hands are full of love. My kids are fantastic. We have this amazing relationship because I don't send them to anybody else. So it's on me. And so I make it happen the way I want it to happen because I'm the adult in the room. They're not. I get to say what's happening. And by the way, I also know when to give, right? It's a give and take. They're an individual. And we've got parents out there, they don't know. So they just go, okay, you go over there. I don't know what to do with you. Ugh, go that way. Put their kid in school because he was too disruptive. I don't know. It's a terrible thing. Breaks my heart. Mm-hmm. The kids know.
Yeah. It's a big mindset shift for a lot of pastors because it changes the way we function in the church world from a church-based programming where everything happens within the walls of the church to a home-based training. And because we think in programs in the church world, I've said for a long time, the program that we are trying to establish in the home is family devotions, family worship. And if parents can be opening the Bible, as you said, kind of the core textbook, this is our core curriculum, if they could just be opening that, reading, discussing, saturating the hearts, minds of children in God's word to help them understand, what does God's word say about, pick your subject. And there's a lot they need to know about based on what's happening in our world today. And how do we live in alignment with and according with God's word? That in and of itself would go a long way. And I love what G.K. Chesterton said. He said, if anything is worth doing, it's worth doing poorly. In a sense, it's okay if we don't, we don't have to ace it every time the first time.
But you have to try.
You have to try.
So, yeah. I struggled with I didn't grow up a Christian, so I didn't know how to teach my children Christianity. Like, we went to church and I was a Christian, but I was like, how am I going to instruct them on being the best Christian? Mm-hmm. Guess what? There's a book. It's like a international bestseller. It's called the Bible. And literally that's all you just start reading the Bible, which is, it's the only book that reads you. You don't read it. And you read it with your kids and they learn, by the way, they learn how to read out loud, which is an excellent skill to learn. They learn biblical history. And by the way, like, you're not going to get it all done as a parent. You're going to get as much done as you get done, but you got to try. So you got to try to do as much as you can. And then your kids take it from there. But the most important lesson that they learn is that you read the Bible, is that you take the Bible seriously. That's the lesson. How did David slay Goliath? That's part of, that's fun and that's part of the story and that's good to know. But the biggest takeaway is that not only do you consider the Bible important because you're making a point of reading it with them every day, but you're making a point of reading with them every day. And so they're important when you show them, because telling doesn't work, right? Oh, you're my most important little bubby. Off to school you go. Mommy will see you at 3:30 when she comes. Oh no, today you have after school care. Mommy's not picking you up till 4 or 5:30. Like, that's the message that they get is, I'm not important. I'm not as important as mommy's tennis class or luncheon or what have you. And when you read the Bible with your kids and you sit with them and you go through the stories and you have fun conversations, they get that message. And that's a much better message. Mm-hmm.
I remember I grew up in a Christian home. My parents weren't Christians and they didn't know what it meant to raise children in the Lord. But I do remember very much seeing my parents read their Bible all the time. And I don't remember a lot of what they taught us specific content wise. But the fact that, as you said, the Bible was something that they valued and valued highly, caused me as a young person to say, if my parents value that, I should as well, with my own quiet time and devotions and teaching my own kids. And that has transferred from one generation to the next.
So in the book that we're talking about, 50 Things Every Child Needs to Know Before Leaving Home, I'm going to show. You can see that. So I'm just showing a double page because this is also radio. On this page, it's knows and understands the gospel And so that's one of the things that you want your child to know. Now, do they have to know, you know, all the books backwards and forwards? No, I've got very strong Christian kids with very strong morals and values. And I sent my middle son to Summit. Are you familiar with Summit Ministries?
Love Summit. Yep.
Yeah. So he went to Summit. He came back. He said, Mom, you know, one of the guys was talking and he said something about, you know, quoting the book of Amos. And I laughed because I didn't know that Amos was actually a book in the Bible. And I'm like, yeah, it is a lesser known book, but you know, I get it. You laugh because you think that he's spoofing or something.
Yeah.
And he said to me, I think if I read 3 chapters of the Bible every day, I'll get through the whole thing in a year. So I think I'm going to do that this year.
That's great.
And you know, that's he values, right? He knows that it's a valuable book, and we do Bible every morning, basically. I mean, we miss some mornings, but basically every morning. And my kids know. And in fact, they asked today if we could do it earlier because they want to get their schoolwork started earlier. And then you also have places in this book, which is so clever. And I, by the way, I did this in my devotional also, because I wrote a devotional about godly virtues that we want to be teaching our children. You have a space, you have lots of space in this book to write things down, because this book is a chronicle for your child to take with them. It's a keepsake, which is a wonderful thing to do. And so they can record not just about themselves, but about their relationship with the parent. And the parent can record things in there specifically for the child. It's a very clever, beautiful keepsake, which I highly recommend. In fact, I've got people that I have to order copies for and send to, because I think it's just great. It's just a great tool that you've created. So yeah, thank you for doing that.
Yeah, you know, and our heart with that is, I make a distinction there between a cook and a guide. You know, children aren't like apple pie in that, you know, if we put all the right ingredients in, we get a certain outcome. But I think a guide is helpful in that it shows us the path and says, you know, here are a few things that you could consider. And what we want people to do with that is really to pick one or two things in the next season of life, 6 months to a year, and say, you know, if we focus on this with this child, and then after that, we pick a new thing. It's amazing what happens in a short period of time. And I guess I just want to share from my own personal walk how that impacted me. So when I was 17 years old, my parents invited me to go out to breakfast with them. So it was the summer right before my senior year of high school. And they slid a piece of paper across the table to me. And they said, Josh, is there anything on this piece of paper that you feel like has not been accomplished in your life? We've got 9 months before you head off to college. And we want to make sure that we put the finishing touches on our time with you. And they handed me that sheet. I'd never seen it before, but it essentially was my child in teen years that they had used as a blueprint to focus intentionally in a holistic approach to parenting and raising adult children who love the Lord.
So wait, it fit on one sheet of paper, but you created a whole enormous book from it? What?
Turn to page 62 on there. You'll see an overview. But yeah, so I felt like as a child going into the pastorate that was the norm, because that's what I had, only to learn that wasn't for a lot of families, that despite the great intentions that most families have, there was a lack of implementation at times. And so I was blessed to be raised by parents that really took serious their role and lived that for my whole childhood. And I don't want anybody to think this is some formulaic approach to parenting, but I think just having a big picture with a lot of different critical areas that parents can pick and choose from, or even add their own, is really, really helpful.
Josh, I mean, there are a ton of parenting books out there, I'm sure. I've never cracked a single one of them. This is the first one that I've seen that interests me, where I went, okay, now this is taking it seriously. And so I think let's not understate the importance in my view anyway of this book, and I'm sure in your view too. The idea that we are in a parenting crisis, I defy anybody who tries to dispute that. We're in a parenting crisis. It's not an education. We're in an education crisis because our schools are no longer educating, but we are in a parenting crisis because we've been educated out of parenting. And so now you have far too many parents who they'll read what to expect when you're expecting, because they think that, that the hardest part is like having the baby. And then you can just allow the state to raise your child. Right. No deference to Hillary Clinton. It doesn't take a village. It takes a parent. Right. And typically it takes two. And there's a reason for that also. So, so let's tell people where they can get this book, 50 Things Every Child Needs to Know Before Leaving Home.
Renewanation.org is the ideal place. We also have it on Amazon, but of course, if we don't have to support Amazon, we love not to do that. So a higher percentage, all the proceeds go to our ministry, renewanation.org, to help children develop a biblical worldview. So that's the place.
It's great. I love what you're doing. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for coming on the Sam Sorbo Show. Yes, that's about it. This is my Sam Sorbo Show. My guest has been Josh Mulvihill. Thanks for tuning in.